Dad Bod, Rap Pod, we are back. We are still in jail. Some of us more literally than figuratively. But we're here, man. And this is episode 100 some odd. We have migrated to the world of Zoom. So many of you understand the kind of audio quality and timbre of Zoom. Rock with this. Give us some forgiveness in this period, but it's good to see the bros. My name is Damone Carter, aka Dim One. I am joined by Wolfman Nate LeBlanc.
Hey, I trimmed my beard. This is trimmed.
Holy shit.
Yeah. Okay. You should see the back of my neck. That's where it's very wolfen.
Yeah.
I miss my barber so much.
Man, so much. So much. A guy who apparently doesn't miss his barber is Mr. David Ma. How's it going, man?
It's going well, man. It's going well, guys. I wish I could reach through the screen and touch your beards.
You almost can.
Yeah. It's going to be long enough pretty soon.
Well, I'm Asian, so this is my full beard.
Yeah. So. I love it. You're great. So we're back. The gang's back together on Zoom. We are just coming off of Easter weekend, and I think that this was probably the weirdest Easter since the first one.
Nice.
I would have said on record, but the first one was kind of wild if you think about it. One day seems to melt into the other, so... didn't do too much. You guys do anything of noteworthy, extravagant? Not really.
No. I had a family chat thread, and my funny cousin, Jeff, kicked it off, and he's like, okay, I'll be there at noon. I'm bringing beer. What are you guys bringing? And then for, three or four rounds of comments, people could stick with the construction of the joke, but then it just evolved into, I miss you guys. And I wish we could be doing this for real. And I'm like, okay, that's depressing. I'm here for jokes.
Yeah.
I don't really do Easter. I'm not a religious person, and I don't need people to put my candy inside of weird plastic eggs. If I want candy, I just eat it. So I haven't really done Easter for a while, but I would have went yesterday given the circumstances of how weird the world has been if we could have had our family thing. But it was a nice day. We took a walk. I brought my houseplants outside to get sun.
Okay.
That was about the level of the kind of day it was for me.
Gangsta.
We found out we have 17 houseplants.
Nice.
Yes. Really exciting.
All right. Didn't do shit. Overslept and then rose and then didn't do shit. but I did start a little engagement on the bird over on Tweet Street. I woke up noonish thinking about the resurrection, and by the resurrection I mean Common's album Resurrection. And I'd be having thoughts. I was like, Resurrection, is this hip hop's greatest comeback album? And so before I really thought it out too much, I put it on Twitter, because that's what you're supposed to do. You're not supposed to think about it too much. Post a question on Twitter. And there was definitely some great responses. Want to touch on some of those in this segment. But I do want to just set this up a little bit, because I really didn't get into it on Twitter. I just wanted to kind of let folks have at it. But Common's album Resurrection comes after his debut, Can I Borrow a Dollar? And in the thread, which is 30 plus people, Can I Borrow a Dollar is remembered very, very fondly. And I distinctly remember at the time, there was this thing of debate about, is Common kind of a wacky dude? Is he biting Dos FX? Where is Chicago? All of these things. And so the reason why I felt like I could make this heretical post was because when Common dropped Resurrection, there was a tangible sense that he was coming back from something. He was.
I think he thought It was his resurrection. That's why he titled it like that. Like, he wasn't like thinking about the semantics of how many albums it takes before you're allowed to put out a comeback album. It was his comeback.
He framed it that way.
Yes.
Yeah. He framed it that way. Right.
I hate Can I Borrow a Dollar. I find it to be basically unlistenable. And I love Resurrection, which I think has gotten an unfair reputation as being boring now. But like back then, that was about as high level of rhyming as you could get. It's a one producer album.
Yeah, right? No idea.
It has great scratches by Mr. Sinister. Like, it's a very, very, very good record. I don't know if it's like an all-time classic, but it's a really, really good record, and a record I've listened to a lot. So I heard what you were saying, but it was interesting how it got everything going. But the fact that he thought it was means that it is, I guess, is my
point. Yeah. Well, I think the semantic part is that, like, the comeback would be the third album, right? Because, like, the first of the is the debut, the second, like, you suck, and then you come back full force for the third. So I think that's sort of where the semantic issues were. But, I mean, if that's the case, then anybody with the first whack album is coming back on their second.
Kind of.
You know?
Like Mobb Deep. A lot of people mention Mobb Deep.
Right.
It's a different group. You know what I mean? It's like they're little kids essentially on the first one, and the second one is like an all time classic. So it's an interesting point of comparison.
And I do want to flag a bunch of folks on the timeline did bring up Mobb Deep's second album, which I'll say yes is definitely a reinvention. To your point, Dave. The honorable and wise O-Dub, Oliver Wang, on our timeline posted this. Maybe this is pedantic to me. Your sophomore album can't be a comeback based on the basic understanding of the term itself. The earliest an artist could have a comeback album would be number three, following on a promising first, pointing second. So pretty much when O-Dub kind of tells you your whole premise is wrong, it is. being that this is the internet, we will continue this segment a little bit further. A lot of people pointed out that Common's album, they consider Common's album B to be his real comeback record, which is super interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
With Electric Circus coming before him, his I've Been With Erykah Badu weird record, which I enjoyed parts of for sure. So there were a bunch of folks, including Eric Toulis, concerning all of the hate that Electric Circus received, the comeback album is most certainly the one that followed it, which is B, which I kind of like B. It's all right.
It's kind of a weird thing that Common needs so many comeback records in his career. Right. Like, how many do you get if we're being semantic? Like, it's just, I don't know that he was ever irrelevant. And that's kind of the thing. It's like at the beginning, he's like the main guy from Chicago that's not Twista. Mm-hmm. And he's like carving his own lane. Then he just got kind of weird. And then he came back from that with Kanye, which at a time where getting a Kanye pack was like probably the best thing that could happen to your career.
Absolutely. Right.
And then I see a better case for Resurrection than for B, because like even if that wasn't artistically successful, it was a big record. Like it did, I don't know, normal size mid-major label numbers, I imagine.
Right.
I had a copy at one point. Yeah, I don't know. It's a weird record for sure, though.
I want to flag someone who totally agreed with me, because that's how you cherry pick. Double O DJ Double O replied, yes, to this day, there has not been an album that has engulfed in such mastery of wordplay and no ID beats. Complimented the vibe perfectly. The album pushed the envelope in lyrics and creativity, especially when Resurrection fades out and fades back in. Shout out to a 00. 2001 was brought up a lot as a great comeback record.
And honestly, comeback record.
If I would have sat down more than 5 seconds and thought about it, that is probably the biggest comeback record.
Yeah, because
the aftermath thingy.
The aftermath thingy just didn't do what he wanted it to. Yeah.
Kind of didn't. Yeah. So Dre was really on the.
They thought Dre was done, and Dre was far from done.
They forgot about Dre, even. So you know what was interesting? Our guy, John underscore Liberator, brought up a great point. And I'm hoping I can find his tweet. He called out that some could say that Supreme Clientele
was. Oh, I read that. I remember reading that. Yes.
Yeah.
Because,
I was like,
because Ghost went to jail. Yeah. not because Iron Man was a disappointment, which we know it's a universally beloved classic.
Right. Right.
It's impossible to find fault with.
We all love it.
Yeah, but because Ghost went away, he was on Rikers, and then he came back with Supreme and like took over the universe. So that's an interesting call.
Yeah. That's an interesting call, but I don't know if like personal like matters matter. You know right. what I mean? Like he went to Rikers and got some ice cream somewhere too. Like it doesn't matter. I don't think the interim matters unless it is really a part of the career. Right.
By that notion, wouldn't the first Death Row Tupac record be a comeback album? Is that Me Against the World?
In a way. Yeah.
In a way, yeah. Right?
And that's like, you know, sold 10 million on a double CD and has like five mm-hmm. classic songs on it. It's a lot of filler, but that right. would have to be considered among. But we've kind of parsed out what the internet thought. What do we think are the best comeback records? Because I have one I don't think you guys are thinking of.
What's your thought?
And it's my pet favorite to bring up in any situation. Psychoanalysis, Prince Paul.
Well played.
He tried to kill his career and he ended up resurrecting it. That's a comeback record.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one. Somebody mentioned Naughty by Nature.
I don't remember the first record.
Oh, dude, they went by a different name. But see, my semantic argument with that one is it's almost a reinvention. It's more of an invention than a comeback. Right, right. I mean, like Bone Thugs and Harmony had like a first album before East Eternal.
Right. You know what I mean? Oh, but I didn't even know that. Yeah.
They're, you know, so I mean, it's a little bit different when it's a completely different reinvention. And sort of by that standard, I mean, you know, Common was Riggedy Rapping, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's an interesting framing. I don't know if this falls into the rebrand or comeback, and a couple folks pointed this out. The Fugees, the score, their first record is just not good.
Mm-hmm.
Not good. I think, Nate, it has the same kind of problems that Can I Borrow a Dollar has.
Yeah.
Which has moments and was saved by the remixes. I want to point that out.
Right.
Can I Borrow a Dollar is more fondly remembered because you're remembering the Soul by the Power remix. Really saved that record. And there was a couple of other Beat Nuts remixes that made that record come together. Similarly, the Fugees' first record was not good at all in the score.
And then Vocab and Nappy Heads have cool remixes, so you remember it a little bit better. But clearly they had not found their sound.
No, right. And on the score, they completely found it, right?
Yeah.
Before they started committing fraud of all sorts. So, yeah, I think that for me would probably be, I'm still standing by Resurrection, but if I'm going to go with my other pick, it would be the score.
That's interesting.
That's a good one. I think Gangstar needs to be brought up as well. I mean, who talks about their first album?
Yeah, they had bad first album syndrome for sure. They had not figured it out yet.
No more right. Mr. Nice Guy? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, nope, I mean,
nope, we're being super mean to them.
Oh, come on, guys. I think at a certain point in the 80s, you just got to give them a mulligan, man. You're just figuring it out. Like, Primo, I just got here from like fucking Prairie View, Texas, man. That was
he hadn't even had time to hit the record store yet.
For real.
That's funny.
For real.
While we're on the Primo, do you guys want to talk about the live stream event of the season? Everybody was there.
Everybody was there. It was a real moment. I liked it. I viewed it as sort of an interactive experience. At first, yeah. I mean, by design, they're sort of boring, you know? But, you know, for it, just like, it was interesting to see what they thought of their own catalog.
Mm.
So it's like, oh, is Primo going to save Mass Appeal? Oh, shit, you know? Like, so it was really nice to see that. And like, it being... It was just very much in the moment. Like, I don't think anybody's ever going to rewatch it, but like being there and seeing, oh, there's Rakim's in the house, you know, like amazing.
It was so cool seeing people score it like a boxing match. Like watching it on Twitter was more fun than watching the battle. And we're talking about the RZA versus DJ Premier IG live battle from Saturday night, which just passed. We're recording this on Monday. So 2 days after, we've all had time to kind of sit with it. I did not score it like a boxing match. That's like not how I think about music. And this one was more entertaining than a lot of the other so-called beat battle things that are happening where dudes play files at each other and then end up like mostly like praising each other the entire time, like such a mutual respect. And like, really, it was like kind of like the old head moment, you know what I mean? Right. Like it was just like, we all love all of those songs. It was the funniest thing to me is how highly RZA thinks of Gravel Pit and how immediately the comments just turned on him.
Totally. Well, you know, sort of to that point, I can't believe Primo wasted one of his choices on Das FX. It was like pick number 3.
Yeah, Real Hip Hop Remix.
Yes.
Right? Yeah, well, totally.
Everyone's like, what are you doing, dude?
And then super late in the game, busted the Christina Aguilera.
Right.
That was after the official part. That was like the after part, but it... People were grading everything that was played. I was like, I don't know, man. You probably got one better than that.
Right. Totally. Just pick anything from Moment of Truth. You
yeah.
Know?
Totally.
Anyways.
So it's interesting because I did not watch it. I'm not better than Instagram live battles, but the format is just, it's tough for me. Like I
hear you.
It does. It just does not hold my attention, but I love the idea, and actually the way that it's done, they don't actually have to battle. We can just compare their canons and say, you know what I mean? Like, who's got, you know, more bigger records, really? I think at the end of the day, this is the competition of who has the most biggest records.
Yeah. I mean, another part of the appeal was like them talking in between the records and, you know, sort of dialoguing about what goes into what and the insights behind each thing. And I found that super interesting as well.
Yeah. It was interesting to watch their setups too. It was like RZA is like the master of self-branding, has his TV show playing on TV in the background the whole time, the Afro Samurai joint. RZA was parenting during it. Like he was asking his kids to go do stuff. That was really funny. Preem was in a studio kind of by himself and just kind of like doing Wu-Tang symbols at the camera the whole time. But like, I think it's just a funny format. And I guess it's basically, these are like Jamaican sound clashes, like adapted, but it's not about who has the best system. And in some cases it's like, we can barely hear what's happening. There's been no like settled audio format. So it was just interesting, but I liked hearing the stories. I liked hearing the context. Did RZA end up playing any unreleased ODB after teasing us all the day before?
I don't believe so. Okay. I don't believe so. He didn't even play Cream.
What?
You'd want to bust that one out.
Right. I think his sort of go-to big record was Method Man Mary J.
Right. I mean, that is a big record. I don't know if that's a record you win a battle with.
I know, totally. But it could have been, you know, it could have been due to what Primo played before. I don't know. You know?
Right. Yeah.
So that kind of makes it interesting. Like, what do you play off your travel pit? Like, you know, what does RZA match what Primo plays?
Sound
you
of
know?
A garbage truck backing up. well, the timeline exploded when he played Triumph. That seemed to be the big thing, which like, I don't know how long they played the things for. I wasn't watching at that point, but that's a lot of the same violin riff for a long time. That's a super long song.
They just played like the first 16.
Yeah.
But you know, it's funny. I think Triumph is, it seems like it's kind of taken over Cream as the Wu-Tang joint.
I think because of the video and because of how big they were
at that time
when it dropped, like it was so anticipated. That people like freaked. I freaked out about it when it came out. I was just thought the video was so great. It's funny to watch now, actually.
Oh, it's
really low level green screen, but at the time was a huge Mungus record. What I'd like to see, and maybe if I get reckless and brazen today on Twitter, it would be interesting to see these battles posed as lineups. Primo's best 9 songs versus RZA's best 9 songs.
Right.
How would you order those things? Like you're saying, like
a baseball lineup kind of thing.
Kind of like, does Cream the fucking power hitter, number four.
Right.
What do you leave with? Gravel pit never comes on.
Right.
That's like a pinch hitter.
They're
like,
playing left out.
Yeah.
one thing that I found really, really interesting was the love, especially among like kind of like the Twitterati, like inside hip hop head dudes for Royce Boom. Like, I don't know if you guys have gone back and listened to that song, but like, it's a really good song. It's much better than I remember it. And really? I don't think I was really messing with Royce back then. I was like, oh, the guy who raps with Eminem sometimes,
Evil.
Like, I didn't really know him. I just went back and I was like, damn, that's a ferocious song. Like,
okay,
that was a really good choice by Preem to like put that back out into the ether.
I'll have to check that out.
Give it a re-listen, knowing what you know now. I think it'll hit you.
A lot of my DJ folks really like that record. I remember not being super moved by it at the time, but
yeah. Mm-hmm.
I will definitely circle back and check that out. It's funny. Sports is dead, but hip hop keeps chugging along.
Yeah,
that's right.
Through this whole shit. Thank God we didn't do a sports podcast.
We would have been so bored by now. What else do we have up today?
Yeah, I've kind of been thankful that we still have hip hop. The show keeps moving along. Shout out to MVP Nate LeBlanc, who's been single-handedly holding it down while Dave's in Elmwood and I'm at a monastery. But we're back. We're kind of figuring out the technology pieces. We've got a dope show lined up for the listening public today. We've got an interview with some folks out of the Backwoods camp, which I love. Curly Castro described it as Backwoods is a writer's establishment.
That's like, dope.
Yeah, that's so apt. And this group definitely fits within that mold. We had Curly Castro, Primrock, who just released a project called Shrapnel. We have an interview with them. Those dudes are always dope. Unfortunately, you cannot see Curly Castro smoking weed and playing with his cats, but
it was a moment. Trust us.
Yeah, it was. So when you hear the lighter flicking, it's actually either Dave on the yard or Curly Castro doing push-ups. I'm sorry, I'm making visual jokes, and I know this is just going to be audio.
But anyway, I know.
So we got that interview coming up. We need to work on our Zoom background game. Eventually, I've got like a rug taped to my wall. Nate, you're in my spot at your house.
Right.
That's true. It feels weird. Trust me.
This is weird.
Yeah.
Just leave a bottle of Pellegrino there. Just.
It's actually funny. This is very relatable for probably most of our aging listeners. My back hurts. Like, I miss my work setup. Like, I had it all set up with my ergonomic stuff. Yeah. And, like, I had a standing desk, and I had all this stuff. And the other day, I was working on, like, a stack of encyclopedias at the counter to try to get my game back. I tweaked my back yesterday doing some stretching, and now it's, like, I have to, like, lean up against the wall. Otherwise, I'm in pain. So, fucking being 40 is tight.
40 in 2020, huh? Great.
Yeah, man. When we get to our next Zoom, Nate's going to be on one of those bouncy balls.
All of a sudden I just drop out of the screen. Just see
shirtless.
Oh man. So we thank y'all for everybody playing along with our Twitter timeline shenanigans. As always, you can hit us up at @DadBodRapPod if you don't agree with any of the takes, and you probably won't. But for today's episode, we want to get into this interview with Backwoods affiliated group Shrapnel, Dad Bod Rap Pod. Dad Bod Rap Pod coming to you live from Zoom land. with another dope interview on today's program. We have a recently formed unit that describes themselves as a Venn diagram of ill communication. Schoolie D, Stromile Swift, Deaf Jux to Debtless Shrimp. That's the copy, y'all. And that is the group Shrapnel, comprised of Curly Castro, who you guys might know from the program, and also Prim Rock. Welcome to the program, gentlemen.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Big fan of what you guys do. You guys are the upper echelon of hip-hop podcast. So it's really enjoyed. Pleasure is mine.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
No Prim. Doubt. But I let Prim speak because he's way more eloquent than I am. Y'all might see a little more tempered down. I try to behave when I'm with Prim.
This guy got guy's got so many reps as a podcast. He's got like 8 podcasts, so he knows how the format works a lot better than mine.
Absolutely.
I can maybe write it down more eloquently, but, you know. So I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to be active and staying sane and productive right now because it is not a normal time.
No, it's really not. But why don't you tell the folks a little bit, Prim, about your work and maybe kind of leading into the formation of Shrapnel and how that got going.
Yeah, sure. If you're not familiar with my stuff, I've been putting out music now for about a little over 10 years. Some heads know me from way back in the day as Premonition. That's kind of where the Prim Rock moniker comes from. So,
I knew him back then.
He knew me back then, back when I was a cocky battle rapper. I've settled into my ways a little bit, a little more wiser. But I've been down with Backwoods for a long time. I've been me and Willie Green. I was on Willie Green's wedding, so that's how I met Billy Woods. The connection there. That's how that formed. Started releasing music up in New York around 2009, and then, you know, it kind of blossomed and grew from there. So Backwoods has always been kind of a family affair. That's why this project was the first time we put something out together. But I've known Woods for a long time, known Green for a long time. So it was, you know, a matter of time before that came out. It felt really good to do something with them. Castro, I met at a kind of like a battle. It was called Rhyme Calisthenics. It was a an event that challenged you with all these different kind of things that they're all improv, essentially. You'd spin a wheel and then you had to pull a mirror out. You got to battle yourself, or you got to pick a girl out of the crowd and get her to, you know, come with you. Or it was an interesting thing. And the dude that ran it, he was out in Brooklyn, but he was from Pittsburgh. They were short a guy. They needed a guy to stand in, so I went to Philly and ended up battling Castro. And it was, you know, it wasn't like aggressive. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, we weren't it wasn't like a head-to-head battle. It
was more Zilla Rocco was trying to get in my head because I knew Zilla just from, you know, the internet and doing some things. And I booked him in Brooklyn to do something like earlier that year. And he was trying to get in my head. He's like, "You're not going to be Castro. You're not going to be Castro." I'm like, "Fuck, who's this guy?" I'm like, you know, and I'm thinking I can't lose. This is my wheelhouse. This is what I want to do. We ended up, you know, hitting it off and became friends. And then from then on, that's kind of how it all started. And then, you know, before, you know, Wrecking Crew was something that was already in formation and I kind of got added to the fray a bit later, but it was all really natural, all really organic. I add a different element to the sound, to the crew, and you know, hopefully if this is your introduction to me, then you like what I do.
That's dope. Thanks for sharing that. Yeah. So this new record, Shrapnel, just came out. Yourself, Castro, it's kind of like a Backwoods family thing. Can you talk a little bit about just kind of how you guys collaborated? Was it a remote thing where you kind of bouncing ideas back and forth? It's like the rap world is different nowadays and that you can collaborate across the world, really. Yeah. So kind of how did it come together as a record between y'all?
Cool. I'll start with that. He would come up to my apartment. We made the idea to make the record after I had a pack from Elucid and he had a pack from Elucid. We were both aware that each other had a pack of beats from Elucid. And it was, you know, early on, and it was a couple of years ago now at this point. So Elucid wasn't all over producing. So I think we benefited from having first crack at some of these sounds, and then we put it together. Mm-hmm. And it was a it was a revelation and like a great idea that was sitting right in front of our faces. And he would come up to Harlem, he would crash. We'd work until like super late or early, depending on what you looked at. And we'd take turns writing and recording. I had a studio that was super accessible and in my house. I don't currently, but you know, we would do. It was I think a throwback. You know, sleeping on the couch. You know, he'd be crashing on the couch. I'd be recording. He'd wake up. He'd record, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, we each have our own inherent vices that we would indulge in and get our minds ready to do it. It was, you know, it's kind of a romanticized way to make a record, but it is how we did it. We did almost every down to the last detail of the record together. So
that's super dope, because that's not something that necessarily happens all the time anymore. No judgment. Yeah. On remote assemblage of records. That's pretty much all we got now. Castro, I really wish that people could have a visual right now, because I think I've seen you roll a blunt and then you have like a dog and a cat waiting for a horse to pull up. But what was your approach on this record? You've had a couple of joints out in the past couple of years. What kind of was there a different energy you were bringing to Shrapnel? Like, how did you come into that work?
Well, to be honest, the writing on Shrapnel, we all did, you know, in the same space, which we said is really rare. And there's like a play, it's not a playful competition. It's just like, what do I need to do and what does Prem need to do to make this song just bang it? Like, so if he started it, then I had to match his level. If I started it, he had to match my level. If the hook started it, we had to, you know, meet the hook where it was at. So it was just, because I can't sit there and say we were like competing with each other, but we were definitely like one-upping, like, I'm like, Prem's not watching me on this track. No, I gotta come with this. But to truth be told, y'all, there was a lot of concepts and writing that was going on like simultaneously. So there wasn't a lot of Cannabis LL type thing. It was just like, if I knew Prem was on like level 8, I was like, all right, I need to be on level 7.5 at the least. And just a lot of natural writing. We would just sit there and write till 5 and 6 in the morning and, you know, pass out intermittently, write, record demos. He would fall asleep, I'd listen to his demo, I'd get some ideas, and vice versa. So we were just trying to keep the blade sharp. And then it was just me and Prem had an idea, because it was a Lucid Beats, because we had Willie Green work, and we was like, yeah, we can pitch this to Backwoods. So right then you already know that the quality has to be of a certain level. And it's not to say that our solo material isn't, but you do go in thinking like, all right, this is a writer's establishment, because that's what Backwoods is. And so when you have that in front of you, you have no choice but to at least perform, or at least like kill yourself, you know, get right or die trying and shit. Like, that's Backwoods. It's like, get right or die trying. You don't have to get rich. It would be nice. But, you know, yeah, you got to write them blades and shit. So Prem is an amazing writer, you know, hands down. So when I'm working with Prem, I always have to go into another echelon. And so that was the whole project. So that was the challenge for me, just to meet Prem where he stands.
So I listened to the EP and the album straight back to back. I listened to the album first and then the EP. So a little bit backwards, but I was struck by how many different things you guys reference, like throughout the course of the 20 or so songs or something. And I was curious if you kind of take the references as jumping off points, or if it's just the things that are swimming around inside your mind anyway. It's like, it's old NBA players, it's Game of Thrones, it's comic books, it's X-Men especially. It's just like, there's so many different things that you're drawing from. And I guess I'm wondering, like, do you kind of track it and be like, oh, like, I don't want to mix metaphors, so I can't say like I'm, you know, shooting like Cyclops on this thing, because I already said a different comic book over here, or like just how putting the puzzle together.
That's a great question, Nate. Well, just as writers and the type of writing me and Prem try to achieve, we go in not trying to repeat ourselves at all on anything we've done. Like, we never really want to even use the same words if that's possible. So definitely the metaphors don't knowingly repeat. I do have like a fresh fetish. If you look through my rhymes, you'll find about 5-6 fresh references. And so, you know, Chuck E, I can't get over it. But it's pretty much like, it's like a Wrecking Crew pen. It's just how we all, you know, the MCs of Wrecking Crew, the thing about Wrecking Crew, I always want to elaborate to people, is we're friends first, and we just happen to make music, and then we just happen to make it together. So, like, we're all four of us are friends who talk about the NBA heavily. Two of us are comic book heads that collect or read heavily.
Yeah.
One of us is a producer file who talks to producers like Micah did on Heroes and shit. That's Smalls. Another cat is Prem, who's a literary genius and who has his pulse to the streets by the people he just knows. You'd be surprised who he just knows. Oh yeah, Barry Bonds. He came back, got a drink. We talked about the clear.
I don't know Barry Bonds. But.
No, but my point is, so those references, that pool, that ether that we pull from, that's just like Wrecking Crew standard. Like, we want the title. We gonna say the best NBA references, hands down. And like, Woodson and Elusive try to come for us, and like, Big Breakfast. A lot of cats try to come for us, but that's not, man. Hey, dog. Like, this is us and shit. You know what I'm saying? This fight right down to us, man. You know what I'm saying? I'm gonna say the most obscure, especially basketball, man. If every Cedric Ceballos reference, you might get a Dwayne Shinsis. You know what I'm saying? You might get an Ekpe Udo. Like, who knows?
Yeah, I'm on an island with the football. I mean, only me and Woods talk about football anymore.
Yeah, him, they go half the football. But
we're done. We're done.
Me and Zillow talk the comic shit. So
exactly.
I talk the sci-fi shit. So it's just
comics are a bit of my blind spot. I don't know what he's talking about sometimes. So that'll help me. Then I go back to check out what he's talking about. So it works out.
We research each other's shit post-coitus, if you will. We definitely like, oh man, what was that? Like, what
did you say post-coitus?
Yeah, after we fuck with each other.
Damn.
Yeah, I don't know about that, man.
That's good podcasting, bro. I just had to call that out.
Yeah, I know. I thought you were gonna let it slide.
That's dope. I just thought you didn't know what it meant. All
right. So after the blindfold and the cigarette for the firing line, we usually go over each other's shit, and maybe a year later we'd be like, oh, you know what I'm saying? But like, me and Prem have a natural yin and yang to how we, I have a different voice, he has a different voice, he has a little different literary references, as do I, but we fit well together. It's like, again, it's like the idea that was right in front of us. Because anytime, early in Shrapnel, we brought it up to a couple of our, writer friends. That was the first people that kind of knew. Cassie, we knew that, wrote hip-hop literature and all that other stuff. And we just said, I'm working with Prem. And as soon as I would say it, everybody be like, oh, that's a great idea. And Prem would have the same exact experience. Like, oh, yeah, I'm doing something with Cassie. Like, oh, that's a perfect idea. So a lot of that stuff just was naturally born out of that. It's just the lingo that we just, feel comfortable.
Yeah, with. It was punctuated by when we would mention Elusive, they would be like, oh, wow, with the beat.
Right.
So like, that I think is... that would pique people's interest, and they were in the beginning. They were like, "Oh yeah, like you and Castro, yeah, it makes sense. You guys have done songs together." But when we threw that wrinkle in, I think that's what kind of made this record special.
So I was checking out Fashion Week, the video that you guys made, and it struck me because it's jarring, and you guys have a lot of references and stuff. But is it? I just wanted to know what your sort of approach is to making music videos for your music and sort of aligning all the dynamics and all the visuals together. Like, what was that process like?
Well, Castro gets a credit for sure for Lupin and Blueprint. I've been a fan of Blueprint for a long time. I had never met him, and it's funny, we had all these mutuals. We had the same booking agent for years. We just had never crossed paths in person. And he was like, yo, Print makes videos. They're crazy. He's willing to work with our budget. He's willing to come to New York. And I was like, oh, wow. I didn't even, that wasn't even on my radar. And he came back with Treatments, and he had listened to the whole record. And he came out with the Fashion Week Treatment.
He came with three Treatments. Came with three Treatments. We would have three videos.
Yeah, true. And Fashion Week stuck out to me. Funny enough, I got a friend of mine, and where Castro mentions that I know random people. I bartend in Harlem, so I end up being around almost every type of person that you can imagine. You know, like I could be on a first name basis with Sway, or like a principal, or a drug dealer, or whatever. And so I come across a lot of people. So I'm like, hey, I need mannequins. Homeboy's like, oh, why don't you ask me? He runs a high end like fashion spot and got me mannequins, got me tape and all
the night before the shoot.
Right before the shoot, a clothing rack and all that. So I had to go down and pick it up the morning of the shoot. And we ended up coming up with all the props that Print needed. He's like, we need this, 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 and this. And I think trusting him was a big part of making this video successful. Trusting someone like Print. If you don't, you know, have faith in the person that you're booking to do the video, I think that that's going to be a problem. Because then you're going to have all these tweaks at the end, and you're going to be like, whoa, do we have this? Can we get this? He had a literal checklist. I got all the stuff that I could. Castro came through with some more stuff that we needed, and it was cool. It was, I think, a tribute to his professionalism and us being able to, like, be hands-off. Because a lot of people are too hands-on, too. So.
And I mean, it's just like any director that could meet you halfway is always a blessing. Mm-hmm. We got another video coming for Aaron McKee.
Okay.
And we shot that one in Philly.
Of course.
We shot Fashion Week in New York. We shot Aaron McKee in Philly.
Special shout out to Print, who was the first person on the set, and he came from Ohio.
Yes.
I came from across town. Like literally just across the city. Castro came from Philly, and his cat Blueprint was early. So
punctual. Hire that man.
Yeah.
And so our next video was shot by our man Bob Sweeney, and that one has a little more lo-fi feel to it.
Yeah.
It's just like us sitting on the Nas rugged bench
edge to it, but
it's us sitting on the Nas bench in front of a basketball court. If there was a Nas bench in Philadelphia. So I mean, sometimes we don't want to hit you over the head with anything. It's enough to keep up with the bars and shit and the blades, so you'll have that. And sometimes the visual will be a little more demure, a little more subtle. And then other times, if you know, we'll drop little things in there if we can. And I mean, to be honest, you know, being an indie musician, a lot of videos depend on budget, and so you try to do the most with less and try to make it as dope as possible. Sometimes you have more access to materials and shit than normal. So you can get a claymation video out, like on Blockhead's video a little while back. And then sometimes, you know what I'm saying, you just, like Griff Company, that's me and Zilla, we dropped a video. If we dropped a video recently, the fucking camera just turned around 360. So we just, you know, we just make what we can work. Look out, my next video, I will be doing the Spike Lee dolly shot throughout the whole video. I've been working on that for a year and a half.
Okay.
I don't care how. I don't even care what.
Yo, Duke Dave, man, do it while there's quarantine, man, if you can. Because you get.
Yeah, I gotta build something. I gotta put it together. But next video, Castro solo.
That's a promise. Like
Spike Lee dolly shot. Check it out.
You heard it here.
So with us living in bizarro world right now and kind of everything that's going on, how did that the COVID shit impact the rollout for this? Did you release it at the same time you were? Did you kind of have to rethink how to roll it out, or does it not even matter?
You're always going to run into something, and none of us could have predicted this, obviously. Or Jay Electronica deciding to drop his album on the same day. it was like kind of like a comedy at that point. But like, I think it benefited us in some ways, in terms of people being home and being locked in that weekend, or that, you know, that was kind of the weekend it all came to a head, especially here in New York City. And people were checking it. You have to walk that delicate, you know, balance, because people's lives are turned upside down. People's families are in danger. Yeah. People are sick.
Yeah.
And you don't want to be like, check my album out. But at the same time,
check
we
out.
Worked really hard. Yeah, you know, we worked really hard on this. We put a lot of money and a lot of time, a lot of effort, and we aren't going to be like, let our album get buried in the bad news. So, you know, if you have time, if now you might have extra time to check out the record. So I think it worked for us in some ways. Other ways, you know, the retail aspect, you know, my dream was to have Vinyl in Amoeba and Fifth Element and All Over.
And it's in Amoeba. Just nobody can go inside.
Nobody can go to Amoeba. You know what I mean? So you had that. You miss the element of someone walking into the record store and picking it up, or talking to my man Evan or Ray at Amoeba and being like, check out this record. Or
and then Fifth Element closed during all of this.
You want the guy behind the desk, as a person who used to work at a record store, you want the guy behind the desk at the record store to fuck with your music, because that is the most influential dude or woman in that world. And I hope that's all coming back. I really do. And it's not like life. I hope that everyone can you know, and I'm not for my own selfish reasons, just for everyone who enjoys that experience. So in that regard, we didn't get that chance. But otherwise, I think it actually may have benefited. So
you know, it benefited us in the way people were able to hone in and focus. I think if not for people being like gravity hitting them and they have to stay in place, some people I think listen to the whole album, you know, straight through. If you were doing it on a commute, you might have checked the track here, checked the track there. If you were doing through Apple Music and all that stuff, I think people would have been jumping around more so than hearing the full length and breadth of the work. And it's a sonic masterpiece. I don't tap myself on the back. That's all to Lucid and Willie Green. It just sounds so great that I wanted people to eat it as a full meal or whatever.
Okay. You know, you mentioned Elucid. Can you guys touch a little bit about like your history with him and just the process of working on this? Because obviously, I mean, he has a name and he definitely has a sound. And, you know, just let the people know a little bit about him and your guys' history.
Elucid, yeah. The noise terrorist. Yeah. He's just, he's a good friend of ours, an amazing talent. We always say about Elucid, he's been in the game for a minute. We've known him since early 2000s or whatever like that, or mid 2000s and stuff, and worked with him since then. And he's always dabbled with the production. Like, Elucid would be the first one to tell you, don't call him a producer. He was saying that, shoot, when he gave us the beat, he was telling him, don't call him a producer. And, but my thing with Elucid is always like, I don't want to know how he makes his beats. It seems so unorthodox. It comes from such a special, unearthly place, probably where the Soul Gem is at. And he goes to Soul Gem land, he makes beats, and he brings them back and shit and gives most of them to Woods and Arm Hammer. And it's like, I don't want to know because it's just such a special thing. So anyway,
The first time I ever heard him, I had known his name for a long time, but I had never heard any of his records. I saw him at a show in like, man, like 2010 or something like that. And he was doing some crazy shit with this other cat. Like, it'll escape me. I'll find out after. I'm sure it'll come to me. But it was like this real experimental, wild shit.
Concrete Sound
System? I have no idea. Yeah, Concrete Sound
System. Yeah, Concrete Sound System, sir.
And I saw that and I was like, I don't even, my brain at that time, I didn't really know what to do with it. And then
picture Milo's setup, Milo's current setup. Elucid was doing that back in 2010.
But it was wild, noisy, wild, experimental. It was wild. Yeah. It was, you know, and there was a devout crowd of people that were really into the shit. And it took a little bit for me to get into that. And then he did a cult favorite with And Breakups, which was at that time we were hanging out at shows a lot. It was a really interesting era in New York, and that's when Woods dropped History Will Absolve Me. Or he dropped History of Absolve Me, then came Cult Favorite. And I was just like, we were doing a lot of shows. We were seeing each other a lot. It was a really cool breeding ground. Me and Willie Green did a record then around that time. And I just saw him all the time. You know, we all went through different phases. He's like, you know, he's a family dude now. I don't see him often nearly, but there was a time when we would see each other a lot around doing shows. You know, we built a rapport, mutual respect. Liked hanging out. It's different when you like drinking with somebody, you like kicking with somebody. You know, sometimes you can like, you know, there's certain artists that like I've been friends with for a long time, or we seek each other out, we text each other, and we don't have a song together, you know, because it's not really about that. And I think that's how it started from my personal experience with Elucid. And I was just a fan of his work, and I like kicking it with him. I like kicking it with Woods, him and Green. It was funny, it was good times. And Breakups, the character as well. And, you know, time moved on and just looking at his catalog since that time. And it's like, man, unassailable. He changes. He progresses. He doesn't do anything the same way twice.
Nope.
And to hear him get excited about this project was the extra push I think Castro needed. You know, it wasn't, he didn't just send him over, you know what I mean? And he could have, and he could have gone on to the next thing. And nobody would have faulted him for that at all. He already did enough. But to him, to do more deeper dives into the beats, there's one person that when Willie Green gets it, Alusa doesn't, you know, he's like, that's cool. It's in good hands now. You know what I mean? They've Green's mixed so much of Alusa's stuff that he allows him to hand off. So I hope that answers the question. But yeah, that's what I got. Yeah.
Cool. Thanks, guys. I've got kind of a wrap-up question here, and we'd love to hear from you both on it. Maybe Castro first and then Prem. So you obviously have a lot of chemistry. You've had kind of a interesting time putting this out because the world changed on you. But I feel like in our world, people are responding to it. It's a very good record. And I guess what I want to ask you guys is this an ongoing concern? Are you a group? Is Shrapnel going to be a thing? And we're going to see more from you coming out at some point.
Oh, hell yeah. I mean, no, we're going to keep cooking. We are a wrecking crew. That's our bigger crew. That's Zilla Rocka, Small Pro, Prem, and myself. So, you know, we always working on shit. But we do like to cultivate our solo careers. That's real important to us. And so when we just come up with a good idea, we just go for it. So, like, you know, if we're able to get another pack of Elusive Beats, and I have another producer in mind for our next foray into this thing, who knows? The conditions might be different because I'm probably not allowed in New York for a little while. But you know, we'll definitely keep rocking it. Look, this is our most successful record to date. So shit, if it's not broke, don't fix it. So we work well together. We'll always keep, you know, rocking it. We got more. We got a little more shrapnel coming, right, bro?
Yeah. We got something else. And to piggyback off that, definitely. I think that was always the intention. I didn't think we were just gonna do a one off. We haven't taken it, you know, we haven't performed. We did a few shows here and there, and they were good, but we haven't been able to get the set together with the record that we wanted. I had a crazy release show playing for Brooklyn. We were in the works of Philly. We had New England, you know, starting to shape up. We were talking about Chicago. We wanted to come to the West Coast. That will still happen when it can, you know. You guys are in San Jose?
Yep.
Is that where you are? You're all in San Jose? That's what's up. Yep. I think I did Back Bar.
Hey,
couple
sorry
times.
About that.
We'll be there. We'll be there.
Apologies. Hey.
Look.
Yeah.
It was, what do we call it? It was a date on the board. You know, we had to get from here to there, you know, and that's what it was. And, but yeah, I mean, it's not going to stop. I mean, we'd be doing, I appreciate you saying all the kind words about the record, by the way, but we'd be doing it a disservice if we didn't, you know, we didn't take it to some cities. I think me and him are also an experience live. You know, we're very comfortable improvising. We got a lot of good banter. And a lot of these songs, like, they deserve to be heard live, I think, and experienced. And, you know, we're hearing a lot of crazy reports about shows not happening in 2021 and all this stuff, and I don't know what that means. I don't know that. I think we might be in a good there's no such thing as a good position to be in, but the fact that we aren't doing Madison Square Garden and we aren't doing, you know, we're more comfortable in the 50 to 75 cap rooms. Maybe that opens up sooner. I don't know. Not open. We'll see. But, you know, I hope the next time we see each other is on your side of things, man. I love to. Traveling and touring is part of my passion, and we got to get this fool out on the road too. And you know, people
killing me, yo.
They have a tendency to believe the movement more when they see it.
Yeah, man. Okay.
Gotta get to France. France is next. And then we got, Prem, tell them about the more shrapnel we got coming soon.
Oh, I don't want to spoil, but we got some really good remixes. Really good remixes. The number one dude on our wish list, he answered the bell. And I think you guys, I know that you guys suck with this guy.
Yeah. Oh. Okay.
For sure. You definitely do. And a couple other, we got Really? Yeah, we got a nice little companion piece coming out. So I don't know when we're gonna do it, but we'll do some. Yeah.
Little epilogue.
Yeah. Okay.
Nice little bow.
Dope. Well, we really thank y'all for coming on. Want to remind everyone, Shrapnel is out right now. You can check it out on Bandcamp. As we just mentioned, touring is not going to be a thing for a while. So while your streaming is appreciated, your Bandcamp dollars are appreciated even more.
There's only 50 copies of the vinyl left.
Yeah, there's only seven on Bandcamp left, and then the rest are at the backwards site. So
that's great. While
we're here, not even playing. Quick, I've never been able to say
we're gonna tax you for the remaining copies.
Yeah.
But yeah. Thank you guys. Dynamic pricing. Do what you got to do. We thank y'all for coming on, man. Appreciate it so much, and we'll be on the lookout for the remix record. Y'all be well.
Thanks, guys.
No doubt. Shrapnel out. Peace.
Peace. Peace.
I hope you guys enjoyed that interview with Shrapnel. I know the audio was a little bit rough. It's kind of tough conducting these things via Zoom call. I appreciate you rolling with us, modulating the volume up and down. It's hard to mix because the file comes all as one thing. Usually we have everybody on separate tracks, but you guys don't care about stuff like that. I apologize for the audio quality. I do think it's kind of funny that one of the people on the call was outside when they were taking it, so there's like weird little bird song in the background on a couple of the moments, which I actually don't find to be the worst thing in the world. So wanted to take a quick moment to thank Bus Crates. You might know him from his work with the MC Libretto. The instrumentals that we're using to score today's episode are from the instrumental version of their Eternal Raiden album out on Liquid Beat Records. Big shout out to Bus Crates. Really thought these beats would be perfect for today's episode, and we thank him for letting us use them. Next up, we've got a special segment that Damone recorded. It's a tribute to Q-Tip on his 50th birthday a little while back and the 30th anniversary of People's Instinctive Travels on the Paths of Rhythm, the Tribe Called Quest album, their debut album. So those two things kind of coincided, Tip's birthday and the 30th anniversary of the album. So Damone felt compelled to record this kind of remembrance audio essay thing. I think it turned out pretty cool. So check it out. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Dad Bod Rap Pod.
Check 1, 2. Dad Bod Rap Pod. My name is Damone Carter, a.k.a. Dem One, one-third of the Dad Bod Triumvirate. Gonna take a stab at doing a little solo segment. Not something I was planning to do today, but I woke up and did my usual scrolling through the stress tangle of Twitter, which I'm not sure why I do that, because it just makes me feel shitty. But during that morning ritual, it was brought to my attention by a couple of folks that there were two important anniversaries going down today. There's a lot of unimportant anniversaries that get celebrated on the internet, and especially on Twitter. But these two particular dates really stand out and have made me want to record a little solo segment. So we'll see how this goes. We'll see if producer Shug LeBlanc deems this worthy for the airwaves. But as it turns out, today, April 10th, on this day in 1990, a seminal album came out for both me and the entire hip hop genre, and that is People's Instinctive Travels by A Tribe Called Quest. It's a really important album to me because this was the first non-Public Enemy album I had ever bought. Just to completely date myself, I started high school in 1990 when this record came out. And to that time, my entire collection had been comprised of either things I had recorded off the radio onto tape, tapes that I had dubbed from other people. Again, as a teenager, I was broke. I really couldn't afford to buy many things, but I'm not sure if I bought it on release day, but sometime in April of 1990, I took my little $9 and went down to the mall where they used to have these things called music stores, where you would have tapes and CDs, even a little bit of vinyl at that time, although that was kind of phasing out. And yeah, I decided I was going to buy something that wasn't Public Enemy. I'm a huge Public Enemy fan, was a member of the fan club, had all their albums to that point, had bought all the memorabilia, and I think I was just trying to kind of branch out a little bit and cop something new. So went down to the Sam Goody, saw the spine of this tape, People's Instinctive Travels, and the first thing that jumped out at me was just the name of the group, A Tribe Called Quest, which at a time when, you know, rap was very, very macho, very, there was a particular imagery evoked with most rap group names and album names. And I just really remember thinking, like, this is the most unique group name and album title I've ever seen. Now, of course, that sample size was really small because I was freaking 14, but it really struck me immediately. And the album cover as well kind of drew me in that, again, I had not seen a rap or a 12-inch cover that had this real kind of bohemian sensibility to it, even though I didn't really have words for it at that time. Somehow I knew that this album was for me. Like, it, even before listening to it, I distinctly remember feeling like this is that new and different thing, and it's something that's going to speak to me. So bought the tape. The ritual in those days was you know, taking the bus to the mall, buy the tape, you know, rip off the packaging, insert the tape into the Walkman, and your, you know, ride home was the listening party per se. So I remember putting it in my Walkman, walking back to the East Ridge bus loop. Shout out if you're from San Jose, you know what a magical place the East Ridge bus loop was, or I guess maybe still is. And I'm walking back, and the album starts, and it starts with the crying baby, which I'm not sure at the time if I interpreted that as the birth of a new sound, which is what I guess the intent of that intro was. But I knew it was something different. I knew that it was something for me. And it didn't disappoint from that sense. This is probably something that we could look back and say the album was a piece of Afrofuturism, just really ahead of its time, strange, quirky, but also incredibly groovy. You know, I will say, like most people will tell you, not the best album in the Tribe canon, but I do believe this is the album that is the most Q-Tip. His voice, concepts, and really his taste in records really come through on people's instinctive travels. It's really a showcase for him and this budding genius that he was, or that he is, excuse me. So the record had a really profound impact on me, and it also helped me understand there were these new emerging threads of hip hop that were going all over the place. And so I remember playing People's Instinctive Travels for my cousin Shannon, shout out to Shannon Dog. He's the one that kind of got me into Public Enemy, and I got a lot of my, secondhand records and dubs from him. And I remember kind of excitingly trying to show him this album. And he was like, this is kind of goofy. Like, what is this? I remember playing Public Enemy for him, and he was just like, no, this is not, this is not where it's at. This is not dope. And that was really the first time that I remember something like that happening, that there wasn't a true consensus around what was considered dope. And there was probably some age and musical taste differences there that were emerging. And I think that was even new for rap, right? Like the whole West Coast, East Coast thing hadn't really got going yet. But there was the sense that what Tribe was doing, also De La Soul, what they were doing was new and different. Some people mocked it. I obviously gravitated toward it because it definitely spoke to me. And so it's wild to me that this album is 30 fucking years old. When you have tangible, visceral memories that happened 30 years ago, it does mean you're old as fuck. But what can I say? Also, Friday, April 10th, 1970, or maybe it wasn't a Friday, but April 10th, 1970 is also a huge date in that is Q-Tip's birthday. Q-Tip turns 50 today, which is wild to say because hip hop as a genre is still struggling with this idea of how to age gracefully and how to stay cool past a certain point. And Q-Tip has to be, one of the ultimate torchbearers in that category, or maybe an exception that proves the rule or breaks the rule or something. But Q-Tip turns 50 today. I would be hard pressed to find someone in hip hop who is cooler, air quotes you can't see, hashtag Nate LeBlanc. You would be hard pressed to find someone who is literally cooler than Q-Tip. And I say this because his sense of what is dope has been adopted not only in broad swaths of hip hop, but it's bled into other music. I listen to house and R&B things and wonder what would these things sound like were it not for Q-Tip showing you the genius of Minnie Riperton and Rotary Connection and his mixing engineering prowess with blending incredible bass lines with really dope drum patterns, kicks, the whole Low End Theory obviously was a pronounced experiment in that was very successful and has really reshaped our understanding of what makes dope rap music. And if that was his only contribution to the culture, he would be cool as fuck. But we obviously know it goes a lot deeper than that. So when we think about lyrically, what Q-Tip has done, what he represents, it's interesting that he's never on these kind of who's your top five list. He's never involved in these kind of comparative rap listy things that we like to do. And it's interesting because I think obviously one of the best voices to ever do it, just you could probably rap the phone book and make it sound interesting. I think Q-Tip is often left out of these conversations because we are just coming into a space where we have the vocabulary and level of understanding to describe what is dope about a Q-Tip. I remember at the time, you know, circa 90, early 90s, there was an idea that Tribe was dope. There was a school of thought that Tribe was dope, but that Q-Tip and Fife were a little bit subpar as MCs, that they were kind of getting by because the beats were really dope, which was always weird to me. But then at the same time, not being able to quite explain why timing, cadence, word choice, concept, song structure, all those things, Q-Tip excelled at very, very early on before, you know, the genre had really worked out how to do that properly. He was on the vanguard of that. And I feel like that's part of the reason why he's still able to record and put out albums, is because the ideas and his approach to the rhyme has aged incredibly well. And hopefully at some point we'll start kind of putting him in the category of the whatever, the goats of the genre. But if those two things, if only his production with the Tribe Called Quest and his lyrical prowess were the only two things that he contributed to this culture, he would still be the coolest motherfucker alive. But you add to that, he produced incredible records for other artists, basically discovered Mobb Deep, helped produce for and kind of nurture Nas. Recently was an executive producer on a Danny Brown record that I really liked, just to kind of give you the scope. And then really helped, I think, the hip hop world understand the genius of J Dilla. I know Dilla had, you know, a number of different folks who kind of helped bring his music into the foreground. But I think Q-Tip in particular probably was a very, very early adapter in understanding the level of genius that J Dilla possessed, and helping him to get a platform in music so that we would be able to you know, digest and understand what a genius J Dilla was. So it's this whole mixture of things. You kind of add to that, Tip is an incredible live performer. I've seen him DJ before. He's a dope-ass DJ. I've told this story on some other Dad Bod Rap Pods, but I saw him DJ once at a club in Brooklyn and hop off the decks and start a electric slide, like a 200-person electric slide in the middle of the party. And just, he has an energy that you hear on the records and you actually see it if you see him. It's just really incredible that all the talent and vitality could be like wrapped up in one person. So we've said a lot about Tribe on this program. I would encourage y'all to check out some of our other episodes. Our Tribe Spectacular, which I believe was episode 100, is a really, really good episode to check out if you want to kind of go further down the Tribe rabbit hole. We also had two different conversations with Prince Paul where he illuminates on some of you know, the history of native tongues, as well as what it was like to work with the young Q-Tip. Those are also great episodes. And yeah, obviously as a rap fan of a certain age, there's gonna be those certain groups that are, you know, legendary titans. Tribe Called Quest is one of those groups. Q-Tip is one of those guys, and People's Instinctive Travels and Paths of Rhythm is one of those albums. And so, yeah, that's what I got. Dad Bod Rap Pod. Please follow us on the socials at Dad Bod Rap Pod on Twitter, at Dad Bod Rap Pod on Instagram. You can listen to us on all the fly platforms where podcasts be at, including our UK syndication partner, kiki.co.uk. You can check us out there. We are proud members of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Shout out to Pantheon and the other 50 plus music shows, the MTV of podcasting. That's what we're rolling with. And yeah, stay tuned. More Dad Bod Rap Pod. All right, Dad Bod Rap Pod, we are back live from Zoom land, Zoomtopia. You just heard me talking for a long time, and that's what we call in the biz podcasting. So that was my first go at kind of doing a little weird solo segment, and hopefully you guys enjoyed that. If you felt, you know, seen or something resonated with you, or you thought I was talking absolute nonsense, you can definitely hit us up at Dad Bod Rap Pod on Twitter, at Dad Bod Rap Pod on IG, for all of our folks across the pond and actually anywhere. You can stream our program on kiki.co.uk. We're also on all of the regular podcast platforms. And because we love y'all and we believe in self-love, Dad Bod Rap Pod is partnered with adamandeve.com. If you go on to adamandeve.com, probably not at work, you probably don't want to do it at work, but if you go on adamandeve.com and check out some of the fly products they have there, enter the code DADBOD and you can get 50% off on almost everything except that stuff Dave be buying. That's a little higher end. But if you use the code DADBOD, you get up to 50% off and I guess 10 free gifts, 6 of which are movies. I can't speak to what the content of said movies will be, but Adam and Eve is not biblical, as it turns out. They've got a different set of products. So check it out, adamandeve.com. Use the code DADBOD. And yeah, keep enjoying yourself. Health, love, positivity. And the Dad Bod Rap Pod.
Looking to expand or move your company? Ohio has the talent you need to scale for growth. Ohio's central location, reliable infrastructure, and top-ranked business climate are here to help you succeed. Get to business. Visit successinohio.com today.
As a new Western Union customer, you can enjoy a $0 transfer fee on your first international online money transfer. Send money to your loved ones back home the fast, easy, and reliable way. Visit WesternUnion.com or download their app today to get started. And your first transfer fee is free. Services offered by Western Union Financial Services, Inc., NMLS 906983, or Western Union International Services, LLC, NMLS 906985, FX Gains Apply.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.